Today on New Horizons, an encore interview with Boise State creative writing professor Brady Udall, author of the critically acclaimed novel, The Miracle Life of Edgar Mint.
Not only when people make a film out of a book, even when they read the book, they take it into themselves in a way that you might not necessarily have intended, and you have to, as a writer, be open to that. Most of my stories, most of my work has some basis in reality, but it's only a jumping-off point. In the novel, you have more time to develop that place that character exists in. And so there is an element where you can develop the humor as you go along. It becomes a kind of comfortable sort of humor that you might not be able to do in a short story.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. If one of your New Year's resolutions is to read more good books during 2009, today's program should be of special interest. Today we're airing an encore interview with Brady Udall, author of the critically acclaimed book, The Miracle Life of Edgar Mint, and a professor of creative writing in Boise State's MFA program. Published in 2001, The Miracle Life of Edgar Mint has sold more than 100,000 copies and has been translated into 20 languages. A movie based on the book is currently in the works. Professor Udall is also the author of a collection of short stories, Letting Loose the Hounds. His latest book, The Lonely Polygamist, will be published by W.W. Norton later this year. Brady Udall earned a master's in fine arts from the Iowa Writers Workshop. He joined Boise State's faculty in 2006. My interview with Brady first aired on New Horizons in May of 2007. Brady Udall, welcome to New Horizons.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Do you ever pinch yourself and wonder, wow, how did this happen so fast? Or did you have this all programmed, that at this relatively young age, you were going to produce a novel and it was going to be made into a movie?
I don't pinch myself, but I do consider myself very lucky and very fortunate to have had things go the way they have. I never expected to even be able to make a living doing this. I thought it was something people did in their off hours just because they didn't have anything else to do or to kind of exercise their demons or something like that.
Right.
So, no, I do. I feel very fortunate.
Now, let's talk about that last name you have, Udall. Some of our listeners may remember that about a year and a half ago, Stuart Udall was on this program to talk about his book, The Forgotten History. He's the former Secretary of the Interior. His brother, Morris Udall, was a congressman for many years. They were both associated with the Kennedy administration and were progressives in an era that was certainly interesting to me as a young man, the 60s and the 70s. I mean, both of them had long careers in the public service, and Stuart, of course, is still active. Related?
Yes, we're related. They're my great uncles. They're the cousins of my grandfather, and they're part of our very large family.
So growing up, would you say you were closer to politics and political talk than, or did that not get that far through the family?
No, it didn't. There wasn't a lot of political talk because even though they were very political and very well known and we grew up in the same town and they were sort of obviously the big famous members of our family, politics was not something that we talked a lot about. Mm-hmm. It was something that was left for the capital, the boardrooms, whatever. In family, we just talked about working out at the farm and working in the garden and who was doing what, family gossip, that sort of thing. So it didn't really filter down to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to your writing and the work that you've done in your short stories, Letting Loose the Hounds, I was telling you before the show that I read one of those selections last night, Letting Loose the Hounds, and I'm in the process of reading The Miracle Life of Edgar Mint. My understanding is that the story of Edgar Mint was actually inspired by someone that you might consider a rival.
That's right. The basic story of Edgar Mint is about a little boy who's run over by a mail truck. His head is actually run over. And the story, he loses his father abandons him, his mother does as well. And the story is him looking for this mailman to find him and tell him that he actually survived this horrific accident. And I got that story from the ex-boyfriend of my wife, who wasn't my wife at the time. She was actually seeing this other guy when she was seeing me. And her way of telling me this, she told me about this guy, and so that I wouldn't get too angry at him and go beat him up or whatever I was going to do, she told me this story that he'd been run over by a mailman. And the one thing he wanted to do in his life was to find that mailman and tell him that he had survived. And when I heard that story, I thought, well, I'm going to write a book about that. So I actually went and found the guy, and he thought I was going to be mad, but all I wanted to do was get the story down because it's such an interesting story. He actually showed me the scars from the accident and so forth, and it's such an extraordinary story. I don't know if he's ever found that mailman, but I wanted to write the story. So I actually got the girl and I got his story, so I feel justice has been served.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Does this guy know this is all going on?
You know what? I've thought about that, and I have no idea. And
you've
I've never talked to him again, never seen him again, and it's the basis of his story. None of what actually happens in the story is his story. So I hope I didn't steal his story, but I definitely took the basis of the story from his life.
Well, it certainly is a story that you could say is life-affirming, considering all the obstacles placed in poor Edgar Mint's path. Why is Edgar so positive, and what's your point in telling that kind of story?
Well, that's a good question. He's so positive, I think, because he's a child. And one of the things that is wonderful about children is they don't always understand what the alternatives are. They have a naturally optimistic outlook. They don't have any choice. They have to keep on going. As we grow older, we see the world as it is, and we can become depressed and we can become suicidal because of all the darkness. But he's a child, and that's sort of what carries him through. And I've met children, talked to children who've been abused and had terrible things happen to them, and they seem to maintain a spirit of survival that I think an adult who went through the same sort of thing might not be able to. Mm-hmm.
Now, Edgar Mint is going to be turned into a movie co-produced by Michael Stipe of REM. How much involvement have you had in developing the movie?
Very little at all. I've talked with the man who's writing and directing it, but they've had very little contact with me at all, and I prefer it that way. You know, I'm not a Hollywood person. I know nothing about making movies, so I guess I do the writing and they make the movie. But it still hasn't happened. It's gone through all kinds of crazy stages and been halted and been started up again, and so I'm not even sure where it's at. Mm-hmm.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time that No. those kind of things happen.
I think it happens with almost all films.
Yeah, I'm sure. I was going to ask you if you managed to get a cameo role out of it. I can remember.
You know what? I'm going to try to. Yeah, I'm going to absolutely try to, because that does happen. I'd like to just be the guy sweeping the porch or something in some scene, just so I could be in the movie.
Well, talk about trivia. I can remind our listeners, if they remember the movie Deliverance, It was written by James Dickey, and he's the sheriff.
Absolutely.
In the movie, so you know you have this possibility still out there.
Well, I can tell you, I really love Deliverance, and I know all about the movie. He was actually kicked off the set because he scared Burt Reynolds so much. He challenged Burt Reynolds to several
fights.
Is that
right?
Yeah, and James Dickey was a big man, played football in college, and Burt Reynolds was terrified of him.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, he had a little problem with alcoholism.
Yes, he did.
And that's probably one of the reasons why everybody was afraid of him.
That's exactly right.
Well, what's it like to watch your story go through filmmaking? Have they given you any indication how closely they will follow the script of your book? Or could you walk into a movie house one day and wonder if this is the same thing you wrote?
Well, I've seen the script.
Oh, you have? Okay.
One of the scripts, at least. They go through several permutations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the man who wrote it, I think, did quite a good job. I was actually quite impressed. But it's always interesting to see what they decide to use, if they're going to use the exact dialogue, for example, that I wrote, or change it. And you have to realize that not only when people make a film out of a book, is it not the book that you wrote. Mm-hmm. Even when they read the book, they take it into themselves in a way that you might not necessarily have intended, and you have to, as a writer, be open to that possibility, because it happens all the time. Mm-hmm. Critics who review a book, readers who read it, they say, this is what the book's about, and you have to learn to say, okay, yeah, it's what you want it to be.
Mm-hmm. I'm still thinking about the selection in your book of readings, Letting Loose the Hounds, that I read, and again, I read the title short story, Letting Loose the Hounds, and I'm amused not by the conclusion, because, boy, that's a gory thought. I'll let our listeners figure out what that is when they get your book. But here you are. You chose a guy. I mean, I guess this could happen to any of us. This guy goes in for a dental procedure to get his wisdom teeth pulled, and he gets all drugged up in the process, and he walks out of the chair and winds up wandering along the highway all bloodied up, and some guy picks him up, and that's where the story takes off. Now, how in the world did you ever think up that premise?
Well, in that case, that premise I thought up, I didn't have to think it up. The very thing happened to me. Now, did a guy pick me up and take me out to his cabin? No. A guy did pick me up, and I had no idea where I was, and he was kind enough to finally, I couldn't remember where I lived or anything, and he drove me around until I came to enough to figure it out. But that's what you do when you write. You come up with good premises, something that will set a story in motion, and then that's how I do it. Then I make the rest up. And that's how that story worked. So that most of my stories, most of my work has some basis in reality, but it's only a jumping off point.
When you say you make it up, do you make it up by, first of all, reflecting for a matter of days or weeks, drawing up an outline so you know exactly where you're going? Or when you say when you make it up, it's like start typing and wonder what happens?
It's both. Mm-hmm. It's really both. A lot you discover as you go. A lot of it you do sort of set up at the beginning. A lot of what I do, I don't really make outlines, but I just make lists. I collect things, things that I think will stick, things that somehow have some relation to what I'm working on. And so I call it my material. And it's just like having a bag and kind of filling that bag up with stuff. And at some point, a chemical reaction occurs and a rabbit jumps out of that bag is how I like to think of good writing. Sure. When I do it. And so it's a kind of an organic process. It's not a very mechanical one.
Now, you know, when I opened up The Miracle Life of Edgar Mint and read the first line of the book, I thought, boy, this author must have a marketing agent working for him. Because when you open up a book and you read the first line and it says, if I could tell you one thing about my life, it would be this. When I was 7 years old, the mailman ran over my head and I thought, I've got to finish this book. Yeah. This is incredible. Did you calculate that at the very beginning of that book, or did you go back later and think, I think I know a way to get this reader interested in my work?
No, that was the first line. Those are the first words I wrote of that novel, and I knew that that was going to be the first line, and I think good first lines are important, and I think you have to, in a good novel, the novel tells you right away, this is what this story is. You can take it or you can leave it. And usually if it's done well, the reader will take it. Mm-hmm. I don't like mincing around and, you know, saying you might like this, you might not, or a lot of mystery. I like to lay all the cards on the table and let the reader make that decision if they want to jump in or not.
And that was Brady Udall. He's the author of The Miracle Life of Edgar Mint and Letting Loose the Hounds, a collection of short stories. And The Miracle Life of Edgar Mint will be made into a movie soon, we're sure. Now, this book has been translated, The Miracle Life of Edgar Mint, into more than 20 languages. I know that authors get called upon to do readings and travel across the country, the Barnes & Nobles and the Borders and independent bookstores. Have you ever been asked to do this in other countries?
Absolutely. Just last summer I was in France, spent 2.5 weeks, something like that, two weeks in France, and we traveled around. Actually, Tony Doerr, who you might have spoken to at one time or another, was part
of this. Was he?
Yes, and we traveled around to 4 or 5 cities in France and did these kind of reading shows where we were interviewed. And it's incredible to realize that, you know, this work that I do about this very particular, small, out-of-the-way place in the American outback might somehow translate and be interesting to people in a place, say, like Toulouse, France. But it is, somehow. And the work that other writers, writers like Tony, for example, other younger Western writers, really do well in France. Mm-hmm. In a way that we might not do so well here in this country.
Well, I was going to ask you about Tony. I do know Tony, and I've had him on the show to talk about his work. Tell me about living in Boise. Are we developing a little cottage industry here of writers who are, and of course the MFA program at Boise State has something to do with that.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I came from Missoula, where there's a really long history of a literary group of writers who are, you know, Kittredge was there starting in the 60s, and there were writers before him. And here it's fairly new, and I actually kind of like that better. But we have lots of good writers living here in Boise, you know, Tony being the foremost among them. But I hope that that's something that will continue to develop, and I think the MFA program obviously has a big part of that. We produce writers, and these writers, a lot of them will tend to hang around and stay, you know, and they're up-and-coming writers. Somebody like Michael Fitzgerald, who actually came from Missoula, has just published his first book, and there are all kinds of young writers who are doing wonderful things. So I think there's a real literary atmosphere here.
Now, let's talk about the MFA program just for a minute, and sure. I want to get back onto some of your work. But what do you teach? What do you actually teach in the MFA program?
Well, I mostly teach writing workshops. I mm-hmm. teach graduate workshops. Most of them are on the workshop format where students bring in their work and we discuss it. We also, of course, read established authors and so forth. Mm-hmm. For example, this semester I've been teaching a form and theory on the novel, where I'm teaching how novels work, the structure, the architecture of the novel. And I think it's something that's very useful to students. You know, we tend to do short stories a lot, but short stories aren't as widely read as novels. And for most fiction writers, the kind of ultimate thing to do is write a novel. And it's a shame that so many writing students leave school without having a real understanding of what the novel is and how it's structured. So that's what we're doing this year. But that's mostly what I do. I don't really teach much literature. I mostly teach creative writing. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting that you mention how the novel is where the action is, and the I'm guilty as charged. I mean, I have all kinds of collections of short stories, and yet I won't pick them up as much as I want to go pick up that novel. And I can't explain it, but I guess I wonder, is there any hope for writing? Is there any hope for the short story? And you certainly have a very good selection of short stories here. And I know that Tony did The
sure.
Shell Collector,
absolutely.
Which was an award winner.
Absolutely.
So what's the future hold for the short story?
I think the short story is difficult. And I've thought a lot about this. I've wondered, you know, I thought, well, if it's shorter, shouldn't it, for, you know, Americans are busy. Wouldn't they like something that something, you know, beautiful and succinct? But there's something about the novel where you get to know a character and you get to live with that character. And the actual act of reading over a certain amount of hours, you dedicate yourself to that character, that life, in a way that you might not in a short story. But I think, you know, I think there is a future for short stories. There are a lot of people that still read them. I love them. And it's a really good way to learn how to write. Mm-hmm. You know, the learning curve is a very difficult one in learning to write fiction. And trying to just start writing novels is an almost impossible feat. I think of it as like, you know, trying to just build a house without having any carpentry mm-hmm. skills. So you can hone them with the short story. But some of our greatest writers have been primarily short story writers. Hemingway, I don't think, was a great novelist. He was a great short story mm-hmm. writer.
And every now and then, you'll find a short story turned into a movie. Brokeback Mountain's a great example
Absolutely.
Of that.
Absolutely. Many, many. And it works. I think short stories work better in movies, mm-hmm. better than most novels do.
Speaking of stories published in magazines, you had an interesting experience. In 1998, Esquire magazine published a story you wrote called The Lonely Polygamist. The main character, Bill, is an ex-Mormon with 4 wives and 31 children. He lives in Salt Lake City and has to work hard to keep his lifestyle a secret. Now, if that sounds familiar to anybody listening, it's because there is an HBO series out called Big Love. Is there any doubt in your mind that the folks over there at HBO or whoever wrote and produced and directed this thing picked up your story and said, hey, here's an idea, and off they run with it?
Well, there's not a lot of doubt in my mind, to be honest with you. And I have to be careful of what I say because I don't want to get sued. I have no proof that they did that, but it seems very suspicious to me. And I went through a lot of time trying to figure out if we would sue them or what we would do, but there is absolutely no proof that they've done that. But it's very bothersome to me, mostly because I'm working on a novel called The Lonely Polygamist. And so it deals with a lot of the same themes with polygamy. And it kind of stopped my work on the novel for a while, thinking, oh, there's this show on HBO that's doing the same thing that I'm doing. But then I realized, you know what? Whatever I'm doing is going to be very different from what they're doing. I don't watch the show. I hope nobody else will watch the show. To be honest
really?
With you.
Well, I must say, I've never watched the show. I've heard about it. I did know about it, but yeah. I'm just amazed. So you have consulted a lawyer, and I mean, you're no lawyer, and I'm no lawyer, but I guess the issue is, how do you prove that?
Yes, there has to be a certain level of proof. People come up with the same ideas, apparently, and so you have to prove it in some ways, and that kind of proof is there's a pretty high level of proof in the United States. It's less so in other countries. Lawyers basically told me, unless you find, you know, some sort of smoking gun, somebody who heard somebody say, yeah, we stole this from that, there's no real case. So I just had to kind of swallow it.
Now, again, I've never read the story that you wrote called The Lonely Polygamist, but I've seen it described as the fact that you like to write about the logistics of polygamy rather than the moral questions dealing with polygamy. What does that mean?
That means I'm really interested not in the why, but the how. How does a family of one man, 4 wives, and 31 children function? How does that work? To me, that's fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to deal with in fiction, I can tell you. I'm facing that right now as I write this novel. But it's basically like the American family writ large. And so I like that idea, and I like the challenge that it provides me as a writer.
Mm-hmm. And you grew up in Arizona in a religious household and later attended Brigham Young University. How does that background inform your work?
Well, I'm a descendant of polygamists. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, I'm a descendant of storytellers. I come from, like many Western pioneer families, we have a history of storytelling in our family. And so those things somehow go together. I'm not sure. Mormons tend to be interested in history and genealogy, and that's a kind of storytelling. And writing, our life histories and all of that, and the histories of our ancestors and so forth. So I've always been interested in storytelling, but I've never used the Mormon element in my work very strongly. And this book will be the first time that I really confront it directly.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Brady Udall. He's the author of The Miracle Life of Edgar Mint and Letting Loose the Hounds, a collection of short stories and a lot of other things in the hatch, I'm sure. I really got a charge out of what some incredibly talented writers are saying about you. One guy called you reminiscent of Russell Banks, who happens to be my favorite author, by the way.
Wow.
I've read all of Russell Banks and think he's just really great. It says, Udall's richest characters are men who struggle to come to terms with what it means to be masculine. When you read something like that, do you ever come away and think, really? I never thought of it that way. Or when you read that, what I just read, you're like, yep, that's what I'm trying to do.
Most of the time when I read something like that, I think, Where did this person get that? that happens all the time.
Yeah.
Occasionally, someone will get it right or see it the way I see it, and I'll feel kind of exposed, to be honest with you. There was one time in a New York Times review of Letting Loose the Hounds, a writer named Jim Shepard wrote the review, and he said, it's like this writer, Rick Bass, who's a Montana writer,
yeah,
Barry Hanna, and Dennis Johnson. And those were my three main influences. And so he got, and I felt exposed, like, oh, how did he know that?
Right on.
But most of the time, for instance, like that Russell Banks, I love Russell Banks, but I see very little connection between my work and his. I'd be hard-pressed to find any.
Yeah. Well, when I'm reading The Miracle of Edgar Mint and how wacky this kid's life is, I think of the other New Englander who writes all, John Irving.
Sure.
John Irving comes more to mind than Russell Banks.
And I've been compared to him quite a bit as well.
Let's talk about the Western writer. When I think of the Western writer, I think of Ivan Doig. In fact, I just finished The Whistling Season, which is his new novel. And Kittredge, as I told you, I'm trying to get through his novel. And Stegner, I've got a lot to read on Stegner. And then you come along with a different slant on the new Western mind or the new Western actor, if you will. Help us understand your interest in the kind of people you're writing about.
Sure. One of the things that I think Western writing has been known for, unfortunately, honestly, is its connection to landscape and almost exclusively to that. When people think of Western writing, they think of mountains and rivers and deserts and so forth. And to some extent, that's justified. But to me, what's really interesting about this place where we live is not necessarily the landscape, but it's the people and how they confront the landscape. And sometimes there's a reverential quality to the depiction of the landscape that kind of bleeds over into the depiction of the people. they become part of the sort of ecosystem or something like that. And I find that I have difficulty with that sometimes because there's such a richness and hilarity and beauty to the kinds of people that have settled this place and come out here and want to live here. It's not always a place like Boise is a beautiful place, but at one time it wasn't. You know what I mean? It was a very difficult place.
Right.
And the kind of characters that came here and settled a place like this and the why they did it, why they came here. I find all that very fascinating. And so I think there's a new kind of direction of Western writing that's breaking away from that landscape and nature-based Western writing.
And both Ivan Doig and Kittredge are writing historical novels for the most part.
Sure.
You don't seem to be interested in the historical novel as the guy right now in the here and now stuck in a really bad predicament and, as you say, facing this landscape perhaps, but would you say?
Sure. I think the contemporary West is a very interesting place. You've got a mixture. For example, the town I grew up in is a little town called St. John's, Arizona. It used to be called San Juan. It was a Mexican settlement. The Mormons moved in, sort of took over, and pushed the Mexicans out to one side of the town. And so you had a town full of half Mexicans, half Mormons. And then a power plant started up, and all these people from the south, from Brown and Root, showed up. And they kind of moved the Mormons and the Mexicans out of the way. And so we had this very interesting group of people. And then we're very near the Indian reservations. And so there are a lot of Apache and Navajo Indians. So it's this very eclectic group of people, but in a very tiny space. And you find that all over the West. We tend to think of ourselves as just kind of white bread, not very diverse, but the West is a very diverse place. Boise's terribly diverse. It's wonderfully diverse. You know, it's just as diverse, I would say, as New York City. You know, the Basques, the people from Eastern Europe, the Hispanic population here, it's wonderful. And it's very interesting, and I don't think that part of it gets, you know, enough attention.
Mm-hmm. You've been described as someone who knows how to deal with dark humor. First of all, do you agree with that? And if you do, where do you get that from in your family? Growing up, was there some particular member of your family that really taught you how to look at the interesting or dark side of comedy?
Well, that's a good question. I've always thought that comedy at its root is a dark art. It's about darkness. It's about confronting darkness. My favorite writers, for example, Mark Twain, had a very dark view of human nature. But how did he confront it? How did he confront the suffering of human life with laughter? Samuel Beckett's another wonderful one. I had an uncle, and I still have him. He's still alive. His name's Uncle R.K. All he did was tell stories. Some other people would call them lies. We call them stories. He would just come up to you and tell you some big lie, and it was up to you to believe it or not, but it was always funny. And that's the way that we sort of confronted the difficulties of our lives, was by laughing and joking and telling stories.
Mm-hmm. Now, we touched on this before, but when you write in the short story format as opposed to the novel format, are there any differences in what you can do with humor, with plot? I mean, how does that work when you're working in the two different mediums?
The two different mediums are very different, more different than people might understand. It's both fiction, you know, they both have characters and settings and all of that. But when you work in a longer way, in a longer form, in the novel, you kind of have more time to develop that character, to develop the place that character exists in. You know, in the case of the novel I'm writing, it's an entire family. And so there is an element where you can develop the humor as you go along. It doesn't have to be quick hitting. It doesn't have to be jokey. It becomes a kind of comfortable and humane sort of humor that you might not be able to do in a short story.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have an unusual way in your classes of depicting the hero's journey. You want to tell us about what your students get to see when they come into your class?
Sure. This is the form and theory novel class that I've talked about. And one of the things that I try and teach is the long form of the story that comes from ancient times, you know. And there's the hero's journey that was developed by Joseph Campbell. And most people know Joseph Campbell, hero with 1,000 faces and all of that. And actually, screenwriters now use the hero's journey as a template for most movies. So I chose a movie, and I've shown it a few times. It's First Blood. And what I do is I have everybody watch First Blood and try and figure out what the hero's journey. And it's amazing. It follows it perfectly.
Now, this is a Rambo. This is a Rambo film.
First Blood, Rambo film with Sylvester Stallone. And he's running around in the forest shooting people with a machine gun and so forth. But it's actually quite nicely structured. And so it gives the students a chance to try and look at what seems like a Hollywood fluff and realize, no, there's real structure behind it. And it's structure that's ancient, that comes from thousands of years of storytelling and cultural story making.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've run out of time, Brady, but I just want to say, as president of Boise State, how proud we are to have you on our faculty. We are really blessed by your being here in Boise. We hope you love it in Boise. We hope you stay with us for a long time and keep churning out these short stories and these novels. It's really great to meet you and great to have an opportunity to learn more about your work.
Thank you. It's great to be here at Boise State, and I plan to be here for a long time.
I hope you enjoyed this encore interview with Brady Udall. Next week, an interview with Justin Hayes, Program Director for the Idaho Conservation League, talking about the Idaho Conservation League's investigation of mercury emissions from Nevada gold mines. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research provided by Julie Hahn. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons.